Sairam, dear listeners, and welcome to today's segment of Afternoon Satsang. We will be continuing with our conversations with Sai as documented by Dr. John Hislop. This is the 34th episode, if I am right. And we left off last week at a very, very interesting point where Swami was saying that it is man's duty to be happy. It is not just a minor fault if one is not happy. It is the most serious of all faults which impedes one's spiritual progress and obviously worldly progress as well. So it's at a very interesting point, and from then on it develops even more interestingly. Many, many aspects which personally I feel are very relevant today in the physical absence of Bhagwan. So all that and much more waiting to happen in today's afternoon satsang. But before we dive into that, offering our most humble pranams at the lotus feet of our beloved Bhagwan, grateful for this opportunity that he has granted us. And let's welcome Brother Prem as well. Sairam Prem.
Sairam Arvind and Sairam to all our listeners. Yes, we were going through a very important passage, especially when Swami was talking about what could be said as the prerequisite, so to say, of a spiritual aspirant, where Swami is talking about bliss. And Swami was saying that happiness and bliss is essential for God realization, and without that you cannot progress at all. And as we've seen in earlier episodes, there are plenty of different themes which were covered in the process, and now it is leading on to happiness. And maybe we'll go to the next question that Hislop is asking, and we can take it on from there. It's also related to bliss, I think, right?
Yes, absolutely. Just to cover up, you know, just read out the last part what we had read last time. So Hislop says, Swami said it is man's duty to be happy. And Swami responds, happiness is essential for God realization. It is one of the major gates to divinity. It is not just a fault if a person is not happy. It is one of the most serious of all faults. It's a barrier to realization. Mostly people are unhappy because of worldly pursuits, attachments, enjoyments, too much interest in the world. To get free of this fault, a person has to be told of the seriousness of the fault. He or she should realize that desire is never ending, like waves of the sea. To which Hislop asks, Swami says that pleasure or happiness is an interval between two sorrows. What is the implication? And Swami says, pleasure is an interval between two sorrows. Remove the sorrow and only pleasure and delight remains. But nobody troubles to find the cause of sorrow. It is like the lady who went to look for a lost needle under the street lamp because there was no light in the house where she had actually lost the article. The house is lit by the light of wisdom. The lost item must be found where it is lost. Actually, sorrow and pain are caused by desire. The cure is to use the same desire and turn it to God, to desire God. Instantly, suffering will cease because the cause, turning from God to worldly desire, has been eliminated. The incidents that cause sorrow will cease to cause sorrow. If a person called my suffers, there is a direct pain in oneself. But if one's desire is for God only, that pain will cease. It's so magnificent over here, you know, especially the analogy that Swami gives. He says that there is a lady who loses a needle inside her house, but then is searching for that same needle outside under the street lamp because it is brighter there. And Swami says, man is like that. He searches for joy. He searches for pleasure outside. You know, whether it is in money or whether it is in a career or whether it is in relations, whether it is in friendship. Man feels that the world outside, the people outside are responsible for his joy and his pleasure and his suffering. He feels that it is the duty of the world, it is the duty of people around to do something so that he or she can be happy. Swami says that is foolishness. It is as foolish as the lady who went searching for the needle under the street lamp simply because the light is over there. No, you will never find the needle there because you lost the needle at home. So too Swami says, the spring of joy is within you. And as long as you don't put efforts to discover that, you're never ever going to be happy through your life.
It's a very beautiful analogy, as you're saying. And this question itself leading on from, you know, when Swami says happiness is it's an interval between two pains.
Mm.
A lot of people would say that why Swami says it this way. In fact, if you go through many of Swami's discourses, Swami will always say that happiness is an interval between two pains, rather than saying pain is an interval between two happiness. I mean, the number of times that Swami quotes the former is much, much more. And it seems like a little negative way of putting it, rather than saying that, you know, there's pain and sorrow will come and go, but happiness is always there.
As far as my knowledge goes, I don't know if Swami has ever said the other way.
Right, I think he hardly said it the other way.
That pain is an interval between two pleasures. I don't think ever he said that.
And the way Swami is explaining it here is very, very beautiful. Even though Swami is saying that pleasure is an interval between two pains, he's speaking of pleasure or happiness as being natural. Right? I think we had even come across that passage the last time where Swami was saying that if you're happy and you're walking down the road, nobody will come and ask you any questions. Only if you have a castor oil face, people will come and ask you what's wrong with you.
Hmm.
So here also again, Swami is reiterating that point that happiness is a natural state, but sorrow is the one which makes this happiness not continuous.
Intermittent.
Right. And Swami is saying that instead of chasing happiness, if you can find the root cause of sorrow and deal with it, then you will naturally be happy. You don't have to crave for that happiness or do anything for that happiness because it's your natural state.
It's almost like that other analogy that Swami gives, wherein he says that divinity already is there in the rock. Like this beautiful statue of Krishna that is in front of us in the studio. That rock has to be sculpted and carved. All that which is not Krishna has to be removed and Krishna stands revealed. So he says that a sculptor is not actually sculpting Krishna. He is removing away those parts which are not Krishna. So also Swami is saying here that your swabhava, your nature is happiness. So remove away the sorrow and you discover your nature. That's it. Instead of that, you are trying to search for happiness outside. It is a useless pursuit. You will never end up happy even if you search throughout your life or throughout lifetimes. Instead, realize the truth that happiness is within you. Search for what is the cause for the sorrow and then remove the sorrow. Just like a sculptor removes all that part of the rock which is not Krishna so that Krishna is revealed, remove all the causes of sorrow so that you reveal yourself as the Ananda Swarupa. And beautifully, Swami also gives the cause for sorrow. You know, Swami says that sorrow and pain are caused by desire. The cure is to use that same desire and turn it towards God. The desire that we have, you know, the desire for companionship, the desire for money, the desire for entertainment, these are all external. As long as this is there, this is a cause for sorrow. Swami says, remove that and replace it with desire for God. If desire for God alone is there, Swami says, all the cause for sorrow will be gone and then pain will cease and there will be no suffering.
It's two things which Swami is saying is, one is either you look within and you look for that happiness within. Swami is saying that, you know, when you talk about desire, as somebody very beautifully put it, the moment you say, I crave for this, I desire for this, it is a reiteration to yourself that I am not complete without this.
Hmm.
And you are instantly limiting your own happiness by saying that I will be happy only when I have this. Until I have it, I'm not going to be happy. It's an assertion that you're giving to yourself that I cannot be happy till this point in time. And as they speak about how the mind works, the mind will always retain this thing that I cannot be happy till everything that I need is had. That what I need at that moment keeps changing. You know, as Swami would say, that when you're young, it is entertainment. When it's older, it is companionship. When it's much later, it is security and the ability to have a secure future. So the changes, the needs will keep changing. But this feeling that I will not be complete if I have this remains. If I don't have this, remains all through your life, and that continues that, you know, that state of unhappiness. And the other thing that Swami is saying is, turn that desire towards God, Because that is the same thing as they say in Vedanta. Either you search for God or you search for yourself. You're going to end up in the same thing because it's the same thing which is within, which is one and the same. Mm-hmm. So Swami is saying either you find the root cause for your sorrow and you realize that you are the one who is the cause for the bliss, or you turn that desire towards God where you will find that, you know, that God who am I searching for is always within. And it culminates in the same point.
Absolutely. Hislop now asks, but Swami, one suffers also because of the pain he is aware of in another. A very interesting question, because Swami is saying only when you have desires do you have suffering. Hislop says, no Swami, when I see somebody else in suffering and pain, then also I suffer. It is not because of desire. Swami immediately says, the suffering one feels for other people whom one sees suffering is from imagination. That sympathetic suffering will leave, but the sympathy remains. Compassion is when love is mobile and flows. Personal love is when love is not mobile but remains fixed on husband, wife, child, etc. Devotion is that free mobile flow of love to God. I feel this is so significant because Swami says that the suffering that you feel when you see others suffering, that suffering is imagination. He says because it's a kind of sympathetic suffering. Swami says that when you turn your love towards God, that is what devotion is. Loving God is devotion, because Swami says devotion is a free mobile flow of love to God. So when you have devotion, Swami says the sympathy part will still remain. The suffering will go. It is so beautiful because, Prem, many times it so happens that when you see somebody in suffering and pain, you get moved. There is sympathy. It is the sympathy that makes you want to take up activity and do something to change the state of the other person. But if you also suffer because of that, it is that suffering that actually stops you from doing something. Because how can you help somebody else when you yourself are suffering? That is the reason why a person who is depressed cannot be of any help to others. A person who is cheerful and happy is always sought out by everyone around. Because cheer can be spread by only one who is cheerful. Conversely, a person who is depressed or despaired cannot spread cheer. He or she will only spread depression and disappointment otherwise. So Swami is saying that even if you want to help somebody else who is suffering, if you are suffering because of the suffering, you can't help. That's why Swami is saying that when you have devotion for God, the sympathy part will remain, but the suffering part will be gone. So that you can actually do something actively to help the other person without you yourself suffering. Though it seems paradoxical, I am reminded of an incident, you know, in the portico when Swami had fallen and had a hip fracture and Swami was confined to the wheelchair. In the early years of that accident, Professor Anil Kumar just said, Swami, there must be a lot of pain, right? Swami said, yes, there is a lot of pain. And then Anil Kumar sir added saying that, Swami, that suffering also must be so intense. Then Swami said, see, there is pain, but there is no suffering. If we just meditate on that statement, it is so poignant, it is so full of meaning. It's almost like pain is something that we meet. It is destined to happen. But how we receive it, the attitude with which we receive it, determines whether we are suffering or not. A simple analogy is that of when we do exercise. When we do exercise, our body aches. The muscles ache. But the act of doing exercise actually makes us feel positive, makes us feel good. How can pain lead to happiness? Because I'm aware that when I'm doing exercise, I'm burning down the extra fat, which is bad for me. I'm also building up my health. I'm becoming stronger. I'm becoming healthier. Just the knowledge of me becoming healthier and stronger is enough to convert that pain into joy for me. So though I'm in pain, I'm not suffering. I'm in joy. So too Swami says, when you're having that awareness, and as you rightly said, that awareness comes from realizing that I am the embodiment of Ananda, or by turning my desire toward God and loving God with all devotion. Either way, when I do it, that awareness is there, because of which, though I come across pain in life, I'm not suffering because of that pain.
You know, there's this very beautiful way the entire Bhagavad Gita discourse begins, where Arjuna turns to Krishna and he says that, you know, I need your advice. And he uses a very beautiful term in the process. He says that, you know, my discrimination is clouded. He says, I'm not able to see what is my dharma, what is adharma. And he uses the phrase karpanya dosha upahata swabhava. He says karpanya dosha has clouded my nature. It's a very beautiful word. Karpanya is a word with dual meaning in Sanskrit.
Okay.
Karpanya actually means compassion. The root, same root as kripa, right? It comes from compassion and feeling the empathy what Hislop is talking about. But the word karpanya also means miserliness, right? So the term actually, karpanya dosha upahata swabhava, means my nature is clouded by miserly compassion, right? So it is like saying, why am I feeling compassion right now? So Arjuna is standing in front of all his uncles and, you know, cousins and brothers. He is compassionate because it is, he thinks they belong to me. Right? So he says, the way that term is explained is very beautiful. Each one of us is capable of infinite compassion, but then we become miserly in our compassion when it comes to, this is my person. Right?
As we show that only to our people.
Right? Because Arjuna as a warrior has killed so many people. You know, he's gone and fought many battles. But when he has to fight against his own people, when his idea that these are my people comes, so that's why he says it is compassion, but it is a very miserly form of compassion, which filters through this idea of these belong to me. Right? So when Swami says here, you know, there should be sympathy, but there should not be the feeling of you suffering out of that sympathy. This, as Swami would say, you know, at any point in time, there are so many people suffering in the entire world. In some corner, somebody is suffering. But we always suffer or feel that empathy when it is happening in front of us or to somebody who is very dear to us. Right? So many times, I'm sure we would have come across this this kind of a feeling where you hear about a disaster, you know, something has happened to somebody or there's been an earthquake. Yeah, we feel sorry when we listen to the news. But then when we come to know that, you know, so-and-so's mother was there or so-and-so's sister or brother was there in that event, and you suddenly feel a little more empathy or a little more compassion flowing towards that person, and you say, oh my God, that's a big disaster, right? Because when you are able to associate yourself with that, there is more pain. Swami is saying that is the root cause of desire also, right? When you feel that, when you go after something, when you go after something makes you happy, something makes you sad, it's just that same thing. You associate something with yourself. That narrow-mindedness is what causes that suffering when it comes to your own personal things also. And the same thing when it comes to compassion. So I think the best example of what Swami is telling here, have the sympathy but don't have the suffering, is, as you're saying, it is Swami. Swami behaves like that. When you go to Swami with some pain, Swami will show you sympathy. Swami knows that at your level you're suffering. Though it is meaningless, actually, you know, you lose somebody, you lose some money, your business tanks. From Swami's point of view, it's like once in a thousand lifetimes you've gone through this pain, and you've gone through this so many times. Swami must be looking at you as somebody who's gone through this hundreds of millions of times. But still at that moment for you, it's a pain. So Swami will show you the sympathy, but not for a moment. He's actually drawn into that grief because he's looking at it from that point of view. That it is such a small thing in the journey of the soul, but right now, because you are attached to this body, you think that it's a big disaster. So I show you comforting words. I give you comforting words. I do what is necessary for you at that time. So there is sympathy, but there is no relating to that pain as such, as Hislop is talking here.
Even if we are unable to go beyond the body consciousness, I mean, as I said, we have experienced it. I'm just reiterating it. If we start suffering like the people whom we wish to help, we will not be able to. So even from a very brutal, down-to-earth, bodily point of view, it is good that our sympathy and suffering be separated and we feel only sympathy and not the suffering. Hislop then continues with the question. He says, last night in speaking to the students, Swami said something very puzzling, that another person's sins would pass to oneself through the touch of that person's skin. Skin leading to sin. And Swami says, for that reason, it is for that reason that some Swamis will not allow devotees to touch the feet. Since one cannot be sure who is bad and who is good, it is best to refrain from touching. Then a visitor who is there asks, is that the reason why Indians greet people by that kind of salute? With namaskar, instead of shaking hands as it is done in the West. Swami says, no, that is not the reason. And then Hislop asks, does Swami mean that if I touch a person, I then commit sin in the same way as he? Now, before we go to that answer, I just think we'll just say, because here Swami doesn't say why, what is the reason why Indians greet people with namaskar. Many discourses Swami would say that this is a way of reminding ourselves that it is the same divinity that pervades all. He would say that five fingers on one hand correspond to the five karmendriyas, and the five fingers on the other hand correspond to the five jnanendriyas. So in the act of doing namaskar and saluting a person, you are saying that with all my karmendriyas and jnanendriyas, meaning with my whole apparatus which I consider as myself, you know, because of Dehabhimanam, with that whole apparatus I bow down to the divinity that is enshrined in you. This is a way of, just as soham, our breath, is a way of constantly reminding ourselves that we are divine. This is a way of constantly reminding ourselves that everything around us, everyone around us, are also divine.
Right, and it's so categorical, you know, the way Swami cuts him off and says, no, that is not the reason, saying that, you know, it's very beautiful also that Swami is very clearly saying that it is not for that reason. And it, and in fact, Swami goes on to say that it is not like you have to run away from people's touch in that sense, because that's the next question that Hislop asks. But this particular thing of people touching your feet, Swami would always prohibit that, especially in the spiritual path. Of course, in the Indian tradition, it is very common for children to touch their parents' feet. That Swami would, in fact, encourage. Swami would tell Swami students that that's a good thing to do. You know, when you go home, or Swami would tell Chinnakathas where the children would do namaskar to their parents when they leave. In fact, many of Swami's Chinnakathas where Swami speaks about ideal children, Swami speaks of that. But this particular thing, when you look at a person and you look at that person as being spiritually advanced, and then you want to go and touch that person's feet, there it's a different kind of a touch where you're trying to draw blessings from that person, spiritual blessings from that person. And Swami would say this, that, you know, it calls for the other person to be in such an elevated state where he is able to take the negative vibrations which are coming from that person and able to sublimate it. And for that reason, in fact, a lot of elderly devotees, when they go to other Sai centers or when they go to other gatherings, there is this habit of devotees coming and falling at their feet, you know, just to express their love and
reverence
towards Swami, which is, you know, expressed to that person. And Swami would very categorically tell, I think, devotees like Professor Kasturi and all, Swami has personally told them, don't ever encourage this, because this will land you into trouble later.
Exactly. I think more than people who are doing namaskar, it is a warning for people who are
receiving that.
Receiving and or giving it out, you know, doling it out. Because it may, if you are not capable of taking that, then it will lead to your own spiritual downfall. However, when Hislop has asked, does Swami mean that if I touch a person, I then commit a sin in the same way as he? Swami says, when the tender plant of devotion begins to grow, it must be protected. When a young tree is growing, various animals will eat it and may kill it. For this reason, a fence is placed around the young tree to protect it. When the tree is grown, it needs no protection. The same animals which would have first destroyed it now seek and find shade and shelter beneath its branches. When devotion is grown strong and intense, it will then burn all the sins of, you know, of everybody else. Until then, the person whose devotion is just new must see bad as bad and good as good. The person who has grown strong in his devotion may see bad as good and see good alone everywhere. It is not just physical touch wherein lies the danger, but in mental intimacy also, bad influences may flow from one person to the other. And then Swami adds another important point. He says, your children are not your children, they are God's children. You should love them, but your thoughts should not pass to them. There is body relationship with mother from whose body you came, and with grandmother from whose body mother came. Sisters and brothers are to be treated with respect, but with other people, there is no body relationship.
Right. A lot of very important points that Swami is telling here. This particular analogy which Swami gives is, of course, very, very beautiful, very graphic of the sapling which needs to be protected. Because there's always this confusion, you know, when you talk about spirituality, we always go to the the ultimate stage where everything is good and there's no bad. Mm. Right? Because we think that that is the moment you say spirituality, you have to negate all bad. There's nothing wrong. Everything is same. Yes, that's the ultimate state that you have to come to. But till you come there, Swami says this discipline is very, very important. This discrimination of what is right and wrong is very important. I think there was another passage in this conversations itself where Swami speaks about that. Again, in the context of parents, Swami would say that, you know, there is one thing to love your children, but there is another thing to correct them when they go wrong. There's nothing wrong in that. The intention is important. Mm. You can still love them, even though you're disagreeing with what they're doing, even though you're saying that this is wrong and this is right. You can still love them. In fact, your love expresses itself in that kind of disciplining. So that discrimination between right and wrong needs to continue till the end. And the other thing is, you know, there are two aspects to the spiritual way of life. Swami gives both of these examples. The one example that Swami would give is that of, you know, that sannyasi who goes and eats in somebody's house and starts getting bad thoughts.
Hmm.
So Swami would speak of how a person who is spiritual becomes very, very sensitive to some of these negative thoughts and negative vibrations. At the same time, Swami also talks about the spiritual person as being unaffected by anything that is around. Hmm. Right? So Swami speaks of both of these things. So a lot of people have this doubt of, you know, where do we draw the line? I mean, am I supposed to be not affected by whatever happens around me? Or am I supposed to be very, very careful of whom I speak to, what I do and all of that? So I think both of these are important. And invariably, it is very difficult for us to tell who is beyond the influences around. It's always better to err on the side of caution, as they say, in the spiritual path.
No, and that we see, Prem, that even if we look at Swami's life generally, forget the exceptions. He himself followed. He kept good company. And all of us as students in the hostel, we would know that if we are good, we get rewarded, you know, either with darshan, sparshan or sambhashan. And if we are not good, we won't get rewarded. Of course, as I said, there are exceptions. There are exceptions where we can see somebody being indisciplined and being rewarded, and somebody who has done good all his life and yet Swami has ignored. Yeah, there are exceptions. There are cases like that. But these things are beyond our understanding. Because when an avatar comes, it's not just about a human frame. It's about a relationship that has spanned lifetimes. So therefore, there are exceptions. But generally, if we see, I'm sure nobody, if you ask any teacher or any student, anybody, any devotee who has interacted with Bhagwan, nobody will say that, you know, you can do nonsense and get away and still be dear to Bhagwan. Everybody will say that, have a good character, you will become dear to Swami. Follow the teachings of Swami, you will become dear to Swami. So, it is, generally that is the rule. So also Swami says, as far as possible, like you said, if you are spiritual, you are supposed to not get affected by anybody's negativities around you. Yes, that is an ideal state, but since we ourselves are not aware what is our level of insulation or isolation from others' negativities, it's better as far as possible to avoid it. You know, I often feel that in an aeroplane when we are traveling, there are parachutes and there are, you know, life jackets under every seat. In case of landing in water, nobody is going to get affected. Because you are protected, even if you don't know swimming, you can wear on the life jacket, you can jump out and you can swim. But just because that ability is there, doesn't mean that a plane will try to land on water. That is just in case of emergency, if there is no choice. But when there is a choice, please take off from land, please land on land. In the same way, if there is no choice, either at your place of work or at home, because of a family member or because of some place where you have to be, if you are left with no other choice than to have to face somebody who is bad company, who is having bad thoughts or bad influence, then yes, we develop that part of spirituality where we are unaffected. But as far as possible, Swami would say, run away from bad company. And he would say, because the influence of bad company or bad vibrations can sometimes be very powerful. In fact, Swami gives the example of a person of the stature of Lakshmana, the brother of Lord Sri Rama, who actually got affected by these tendencies or bad vibrations, if we can say so. You know, Lakshmana is somebody who is so, so dear to Rama and is one of such sterling virtue, more of which we'll speak about later. But right now, I think we'll listen to that discourse excerpt from a discourse that Swami delivered on the 23rd of April, 1998, which shows how powerful the evil tendencies or vibrations can be in affecting even a virtuous and noble soul like Lakshmana.
At one time, when Rama was spending time in the exile, Rama, Lakshmana, Sita reached Chitrakuta mountain. Rama was pretending as if he was tired.
Lakshmana,
your sister-in-law seems to be tired.
So it's
6 minutes.
We may have to stay here for 10 years.
Okay.
Build a small hut for our stay.
I was thinking of actually telling
you.
Lakshmana said, where?
Rama
said, decide for yourself.
Lakshmana
fell on the ground immediately. What sin I have committed, Rama? And Sita was surprised. What is the joke? What is that your brother said? He has not accused you, he has not beaten you. Why are you sad? And so asked Sita. Mother, there cannot be higher accusation than this. I offered everything.
Madhya, dhana, dharadi, sarvabhara, samarpitam, atmanam, seshabhutami, rachamam, saranagati, naku bharyamundi, pilanunnaru, rajyamundi, sarvaswani, tyagam chesi, nenu enduku ramuncho vachanu.
Lakshmana says, I surrendered myself, my wife, my children, my property, my kingdom, everything I have surrendered myself. And when Brother Rama says, you choose the place and construct the hut,
I don't feel sad.
Can there be higher accusation, deeper accusation than using harsh words like this? I committed some sin. Compassionate Rama,
Lakshmana.
Don't feel like that. Don't feel sad. Here is the place you can build a hut.
Tarvata,
later,
while
Sita was sitting in the hut, Rama and Lakshmana was going round protecting the whole thing.
Rama yokka charaname na yokka charanamani, charaname charanamani bhavinchukunnatvanti yokka Lakshmanudu.
Lakshmana considered the feet of Rama to whom he surrendered.
And
he went to a place. The mind of Lakshmana changed. Brother, I can't be here any longer in this
forest.
I can't bear your harsh words. I am going, leaving you. Rama. Rama said smilingly, wait for some time. He caught hold of his hand and both went close to the hut. They sat under a huge tree enjoying this shade. Then there the mind of Lakshmana changed.
Lakshmana, ఎప్పుడు వెళ్తావు అయోధ్య అని ప్రశ్నించాడు రాముడు.
Rama asked Lakshmana, when are you leaving for Ayodhya?
అయోధ్యతో నాకేం పని ఉంది?
Lakshmana says, what business I have there in Lakshmana, sarvamu in Ayodhya? You are everything.
అలాంటి రాముల వదిలి నేను అయోధ్యకు వెళ్దాము నా కళ్ళలో కూడా భావం లేదు అన్నాడు.
I will not entertain this idea even in a dream, leaving your company and stepping into Ayodhya.
మరి కొంత దూరం లోపల నీవు అయోధ్య వెళ్తానని చెప్పావు కదా అన్న.
A moment back you said that you'll go to Ayodhya.
దానికి కారణమేమిటో నాకు తెలియదు.
ఐ డోంట్ నో ద రీజన్.
అప్పుడు రాముడు చెప్తున్నాడు.
దెన్ రామా సేస్
లక్ష్మణ స్థానబలం కూడా ఉంటుండాలి.
దేర్ ఇస్ సమ్
స్థానబలంతో పాటు స్థానబలం కూడా కొంచెం చూసుకోవాలి.
అలాంగ్ విత్ యువర్ స్ట్రెంగ్త్ ఆఫ్ ద ల్యాండ్ వేర్ యూ లివ్.
భగవంతుడి నుంచి దూరం పోవడానికి ఆ స్థల మహత్యమే.
ఇట్ ఈస్ ద మిస్టరీ ఆఫ్ ద ల్యాండ్ వేర్ యూ లివ్.
ఎందుకంటే ఆ స్థలం లోపల శూర్పణఖ సంచరించినటువంటి స్థలము.
విత్ దట్ ప్లేస్ వేర్ యూ డిసోబేడ్ మీ ఈస్ ద వన్ దట్ ఈస్ ట్రావెల్ వేర్ శూర్పణఖ లివ్.
మనం సంచరించాము.
సో వీ మూవ్డ్ అబౌట్ ఇన్ దట్ ఏరియా.
శూర్పణఖ భావాలే భేదములే మనలో ఆవిర్భవిస్తాయి.
దేర్ ఫోర్ వీ హ్యావ్ ది శూర్పణఖ ఐడియాస్ ఆఫ్ డిఫరెన్సెస్.
మరొక స్థానంలోకి వచ్చాము.
And now we moved away from that Surpanaka land.
Chitrakuta Parvatham paina Maharshulanta nivasinchetuvanti.
Chitrakuta mountain is the place of saints.
Ikkadiki vachinatiki Maharshula yokka bhavam vachesesi.
Now we have saintly feelings.
Kanukone mana sthanamlo kudanu pavitramaina sthanamluga untundali.
So our places also should be sacred.
Durmargulu dushtulu sancharinchetuvanti pradeshanga undakoodadu.
They should not be the dwelling places for the wicked and the cruel people. Kanukone
kedu sansargam.
Run away from the bad company.
So that's the discourse clip where Swami speaks about that. I think Swami has spoken about that many occasions. Of course, in our Ramkatha Raswaini series also, we've spoken about it. So Swami would, this is the contrast which I was telling. Swami also says that a very pure person is very, very susceptible to such interference from others' thoughts and others' intentions. It's more like, you know, the best example I can think of is, you know, you go to a very, very placid and still lake. Even throwing a small twig into that lake is going to cause ripples which are so obvious. And imagine a river which is flowing, which is gushing, and you know, it's already having so many ripples and waves. Even if you throw a, you know, sizable rock into that, probably nothing will be noticed. I think right now our minds are in that state where it's like flowing and gushing, and not much of distinction is going to be made by people around us. But the more spiritual that one becomes, it is very important to be more careful of this. And that's why Swami would say that, you know, satsangam is the starting point for the spiritual sadhaka. That the more you want to lead a specific kind of a lifestyle, the more you'll have to look for people who think in a similar manner, who have similar aspirations, who have similar discipline lifestyles. And that is why, even though the ultimate goal of spirituality is to reach a state where you're completely undisturbed by anything that's happening around you, the path to get there is through the path of discipline. As Swami said, that fence which is built around a sapling is very, very important in the beginning stages.
And it's not just about the company. Even physically, I remember that is the reason when anybody does any spiritual practices, they have their own mat. You know, that is a way of insulating themselves from the influence of the land. Because Swami is speaking of Stala Mahatyam.
Right.
I remember even all of us, whether we knew of this fact or not, we would come to darshan with a sitting mat. I think all of us had a sitting mat. Of course, we would use it more like a reservation to reserve our space and show it to people that it's occupied. But irrespective of that, we would get it. And there is a reason, you know, Swami would, it's the famous message that Swami gives about the gift of darshan. He says, after darshan, find a silent corner by yourself so that you can receive the completion of my grace. Don't go and talk unnecessarily. Don't squander away the energy that you have received. So, it is very, very, you know, significant that for such a darshan, we would all be carrying mats so that what we absorb remains with us. We are insulated from rest of the surroundings so that it doesn't get dissipated. So, whether it is in thoughts and vibrations or whether it's at a physical level, it is always better to practice this as far as possible, that we keep away from bad company. You know, people often say, if every good person keeps away from the bad people, how will the bad people change? You know? I think that is beyond the scope for us. I mean, that is not my duty. That is not my mission in life. My mission in life must be to perfect myself. That is the best contribution I can do to myself as well as to humanity. You know, reduce one ignorant fool in the world and increase one enlightened being in the world. That is myself. Because if you look at Swami's life, that's what it is. He was like a beacon and his life became his message. And by observing his life, so many have transformed. Discourses, of course, Swami would give. But that is when people would clamor and ask him to speak. Before even giving discourses, he has led decades of his life where only his actions spoke. It is only when people, you know, began to consider him as God, as an avatar, as a guru, that in order to make them happy, he decided to speak. But in the first few years, if we see, it's only Leela's, Mahima's and the way he conducted himself and led his life. So also, as far as possible, we focus on our spiritual journey, wherein we keep away from bad, we run away from bad company. That's what Swami said in the end of the discourse also. And try to engage in satsang. Of course, the obvious exception is when situations in life are such that you can't do it, that is when we adopt the other stance wherein we try to isolate and insulate ourselves from such tendencies. Like Swami would say for food, he would say that you should ensure that the vessel in which you are cooking is pure. You should ensure that the vegetables have been bought from a person whose thoughts are pure, and those vegetables are sown by a farmer whose thoughts are pure. Paka Shuddhi, Padartha Shuddhi, Patra Shuddhi, the person who is cooking, his or her thoughts should be pure. And Swami would say that it is practically impossible to ensure all these. Since you are not able to ensure all this, that is why say the food prayer, make the food into an offering to God. So when prevention is not possible, then you look for the cure. But as they say, prevention is always better than cure.
And the the other important point, I think towards the end, Swami just made a mention, apart from saying the negative sthala prabhavam, Swami also spoke about the positive sthala prabhavam. He's saying that is why you go to sacred places. And Swami also said that now that we have come back to the kshetra of rishis, now your good thoughts,
Parvata.
Chitrakuta Parvata, your good thoughts have come back. In fact, Swami would say that that is the reason why you go to pilgrim centers, you go to temples. And there's a very beautiful discourse that Swami gives after his return from the Badri trip in the year 1964, is it?
64,
between that period. Swami comes back and Swami says that, you know, this is Swami who is saying, of course, he doesn't need a visual proof in that sense. But Swami was saying that after going to Badri and seeing the pilgrims, maintain that love and devotion for, you know, God, I feel that this country is still in safe hands. And Swami went on to say, see, this is why we go to temples. Because each of these kshetras are saturated and, you know, it's like suffused with that devotion of pilgrims who have been visiting those places for hundreds of years. And that is the, you know, sthalam hatyam of that place. And that's why the importance of being in the right place, right? Apart from being with the right people, being in the right place, a place which has good intentions, which has been made with good intentions. Even in temples, I think there are temples which have been made for a different reason, right? Somebody was recently telling me, you know, they were having a discussion with their a relative of theirs who was in the United States, who's made a lot of money. And he's saying, I'm debating between whether to come to India and set up a startup or build a Shirdi Baba temple.
In US, huh?
Right, because that is as lucrative a business option as, you know, starting a small business. So there are plenty of temples like that which probably are not built with the right intention. But all of these, you know, most of the sacred temples in India and, you know, places around, they're so simple in the way they're built. It's a very simple shrine which will be there. And, you know, you might trek for hundreds of kilometers and drive for hundreds of kilometers. The temple itself will be so small. The idol there will be so small. The very reason why, you know, these places are so important in spite of physically not being so attractive or not being so ostentatious is because there's something special in those places that has been drawing pilgrims for so many hundreds of thousands of years. And Swami would say that Prashantinilayam is also a place like that for hundreds of thousands of people. They've come and expressed their love for Swami in this place. And that is what makes this place so very special.
On that note, dear listeners, we'll take a quick little break, because after this, a very, very significant change in topic. At the same time, it's a very important thing for us in these days in the physical absence of Bhagwan, because you know, I'll just give out a teaser by saying what Hislop asks question. He tells Swami, I gave Swami a ring that was created by a yogi. You know, Hislop has been given a ring by another yogi, and an interesting discussion is about to follow, but all that after this little break.
Ram rasam Ram rasam pibare Ram rasam Ram rasam Pibare 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 Ramarasam பிபரே ராம ரசம் ரசனே பிபரே ராம ரசம் பிபரே ராம ரசம் ரசனே பிபரே ராம ரசம் பிபரே ராம ரசம் ரசனே பிபரே ராம ரசம் பிபரே ராம ரசம் ராம ரசம் ஜன மரண பய சோக விதூரம் சோக விதூரம் ஜன மரண பய சோக விதூரம் சகல சாஸ்திர நிகமானவ சாரம் சகல சாஸ்திர நிகமாகம சாரம் பிபரே ராம ரசம் ரசே பிபரே ராம ரசம் ரசனே பிபரே ராம ரசம் ராம ரசம் பிபரே சுத்த பரம ஹம்சாஶ்ரம கீதம் சுத்த பரம ஹம்சாஶ்ரம கீதம் சுக சௌனக கௌஷிக முக பீடம் சுக சௌனக கௌஷிக முக பீடம் பிபரே ராம ரசம் ரசனே பிபரே ராம ரசம் ராமரசம் ராம ரசம் பிபரே ராம ரசம் ராம ரசம் பிபரே
Welcome back, dear listeners. After drinking the Rama Rasa, as the song suggests, it says, drink in the sweet ambrosia or nectar of the name of the Lord. That is what we intend to do through the satsang, throughout our life as well. We'll continue, as we said, it was a very, very interesting portion where Hislop is telling Swami, I gave Swami a ring created by a yogi. I did not want to wear it and I didn't know what to do with it. దట్ ఈస్ వై ఐ సెంట్ ఇట్ అప్ విత్ అ మెసెంజర్ టు స్వామి విత్ అ నోట్ అబౌట్ ఇట్. అండ్ స్వామి రిప్లైస్, దట్ వాజ్ అనదర్ అటెంప్ట్ ఎయిమ్డ్ అట్ యూ బై అదర్ ఇంట్రెస్ట్స్. యు ఆర్ నోన్ యాజ్ అ డివోటీ ఆఫ్ బాబా అండ్ ఇట్ వాజ్ అన్ అటెంప్ట్ టు ఇంట్రెస్ట్ యూ ఎల్స్వేర్ లైక్ దట్ వెస్టర్న్ సిటీ మ్యాటర్. వీ డోంట్ నో వాట్ ఇస్ దట్. యూ షుడ్ రిజెక్ట్ సచ్ అటెంప్ట్స్ అవుట్ ఆఫ్ హ్యాండ్. అండ్ దెన్ హిస్లప్ సేస్, బట్ దట్ మ్యాన్ ఫ్రమ్ దేర్ సెడ్ స్వామి స్టేడ్ ఎట్ ఇస్ హౌస్. అండ్ స్వామి సేస్, నాట్ ట్రూ. దట్ ఏరియా ఇస్ స్ట్రాంగ్లీ కమ్యూనిస్ట్. At one time, Baba did bring about genuine evidence of his sankalpa there. But ego and money making arose. So Baba stopped things. Again he allowed it. And now he has again stopped it. Those people, in fear of loss of reputation, are now doing things by tricks. So, you know, it is so interesting because I think it opens up multiple thoughts. One is that when somebody starts building money, making money, bringing in ego, Swami's grace abruptly stops. And this is very interesting because Swami is saying, but the man has said that Swami stayed at his house, you know. And Swami is also not denying it. Swami is saying, yes, they were recipients of grace. But once this stepped in, Swami has gone out. I'm saying this because today we have seen a proliferation of people claiming to be voices of Swami. Very close to Prashanthi Nilayam, there is this ashram that has been, if I can say, taken over at Mudenhalli, where there's supposed to be a Sukshma Satyasai, and, you know, that fellow has proclaimed himself as the next Swami or whatever. And people say that, no, but the people there, they've all received blessing from Swami. We have seen photographs of them with Swami. We have seen videos of them with Swami. Here, of course, nobody is denying that they were recipients of Bhagwan's grace. Yes, they have been recipients of Bhagwan's grace, but as Swami says here, but ego and money making arose, so Baba stopped things. So Swami has stopped. I think it is such a very, very important thing to keep in mind. So when somebody else comes up to me and says that I am a messenger from Swami, I can do this for you, I think it's not about whether they're genuine or not, but it's about focusing on the point which Swami says is about me developing my own contact with Swami. Because I don't know whether they are still receiving Bhagwan's grace or whether their ego and money making has surfaced and Swami has stopped blessing them. I don't know. There's no way to know. Here Hislop was lucky that Swami himself said that yes, I showered them with grace. That is true. But then I have stopped. In fact, Swami says after that again when there was a change and I again started showering grace. It's almost like Swami says when ego and money making is kept out, my grace flows in. That's it. The moment ego and money making comes, my grace goes out. So, when that is being made so clear over here, we are not in a position to determine that. So, I think it is in our best interest that we keep our connection direct with Swami unless we directly receive an instruction from Bhagwan in the many millions of ways he can give, you know, either dream or whatever, directly in my heart. I mean, I feel it need not even be a dream. Just the inspiration from my heart. It will come. So, until and unless that personal one-to-one connect is what is making me do what I'm doing anything else, I think would be foolish and hazardous, basing on what X is saying or Y is saying. So, that is what Swami is telling. And Swami here is telling Hislop clearly, you should reject such attempts out of hand. And, you want to add something? I'll just, one more statement that Swami Hislop says. It is very significant because he says, but that man seemed so nice. He seemed like a very good devotee. He seemed very fine. Swami says, not so. There is always good and bad in dualistic phenomena. So, I think things get very, very clear here.
Right. I think, a couple of things that Swami is saying here is very, very important as I think Swami had explained this also to other devotees. One thing is, of course, the phenomenon of people claiming to be mediums and all of that is one thing. The other larger thing is, you know, there are a lot of people who have earned Swami's grace. And Swami is physically available to us. A lot of Swami's students, a lot of elders, a lot of senior devotees. A lot of people, you know, that for 80 years of Swami's life, Swami has been giving out interviews and Swami is... We don't know how many thousands and thousands of lives Swami has touched. So a lot of people have earned grace. And And Swami is showered literally, right? And similarly, the many hundreds of thousands of houses around the globe where you have manifestations of Swami's presence in any form, right? And very clearly Swami is saying, yes, Swami has manifested his sankalpa in so many of these places. That alone does not make a person's words or the person's activities as being beyond any kind of,
scrutiny,
right? That's the word I was looking for. Any kind of scrutiny. Because Swami would often say this, you know, you might be somebody who is very, very close to Swami. It might be someone who, you know, stays in Swami's ashram. But if he comes and says something, or if she comes and says something, you should only look at the word and see whether it is true to Swami's message. And Swami would say this even for your own dreams. Swami would say that sometimes you would have a dream. But you should ask yourself, is what Swami telling in the dream is in line with what Swami would tell me if I were to be in front of Swami? Our understanding may be limited. You know, not all of us probably have spent as much time with Swami as some of the elders. And we may or may not know what Swami would say, what Swami would not say at a given time. But even within our own understanding, Swami says that we have to ask ourselves that, will this be something and be an instruction that Swami would give? Right? And I think that's, for that reason, this is a very, very important thing. This covers all of those people. People who have physically got attention from Swami, people who have, who claim that there are manifestations in their house, how you should take them. Because there are a lot of people who have, you know, who have genuine miracles happening in their families. And just like how Swami is saying here, after a certain point, when it doesn't happen, they're literally under pressure. Then, we have to, keep up that reputation, do something. They end up doing things which are wrong. And Swami is saying, you know, genuinely, yes, I went and showed them their grace. And this is not to point out a finger at anybody else. I think we can speak of ourselves also. Just because we've been students of Swami for 5 years, or just because Swami has come and spoken to me, or Swami has given me this opportunity to stay at Radio Sai, I mean, work at Radio Sai, it doesn't mean that whatever I do and say is right.
Absolutely. Right?
Each one of us are in the journey, and Swami has given us some grace, and now it's up to us whether how we are going to use that grace. And same is the case with anybody who is probably having a grace of Swami's omnipresence also. You know, somebody's house, there's vibhuti coming. Yes, that's also an act of grace. That does not make that everything that person does is right. You still have to go back to Swami's own words, and you have to go back to, as you're saying, that Swami who is within in the form of the voice of the conscience, and then you have to discriminate. Nothing becomes clear in that sense.
But that is very difficult, Prem, because unfortunately the world runs like that. If we look at celebrity endorsement, why does celebrity endorsement work? Because I am in admiration of that celebrity on one aspect, so I consider whatever else that celebrity does is amazing. I like a celebrity because he or she is an amazing sports person, maybe. But, and that celebrity comes and tells, eat this food, buy this car, wear that footwear, and we feel that is, I mean, you know, it makes an impact. So I think what you said makes absolute sense, but it's such a difficult exercise, and we can execute it only if we constantly remind ourselves that all of us are equal in the eyes of God, and therefore if somebody is having a connect with Swami, it should only serve possibly as an inspiration for me to develop my own connect with Swami, or, you know, clear the pathway, because all of us have the connect with Swami. In fact, Swami says Swami is the indweller of your heart. In fact, Swami, he says, you are divine. You are divine. So it is all there. It is like we spoke of the sculptor who is chipping away all that which is not God. We have to clear away all that which comes to block, you know, us in our connect from Swami. So if we come across people who have had this connect, who are receiving this grace, of course, yeah, we should, you know, listen to those experiences, see them or experience it to a certain extent, so that we feel the inspiration to pursue our connect with Swami. We should realize that at no point in time, somebody else's connect with Swami can become a substitute for my own personal connect with Swami.
In fact, the last statement that Swami is making here is so very beautifully saying that, you know, there is good and bad in each one, right? When Hislop says that Swami seemed like a nice fellow, and Swami is saying, yes, there is good and bad in each one. That doesn't negate the bad which is there. In fact, the passage which I was referring to, which Swami had said earlier in one of the chapters in Conversations itself, Swami very beautifully explains that. I'll probably read out those couple of lines here. Swami says, in dealing with people, Swami looks to the good and ignores the bad so as to intensify the good. Swami's teachings is, in a way, just as when you go to buy sugar in a shop, you do not bother about all the other details of the shop, the history and the character of the shopkeeper, his personal relationship with other people, his personal looks, whether he's tall, short, old, young, and so on. And then Swami goes on, the central part of Swami's teaching is, in regard to living in the world, is to see in others that essential quality which is God, and to love that quality and not to be bothered by all the actions, qualities, misbehavior, and characteristics of the person, right? This is one set of instruction that Swami gives. And then the next paragraph where Swami clarifies that is, and the love of God in the person with whom one is dealing is spiritual love and not physical love. That does not mean in terms of the worldly nature of the being in whom one sees the Lord, that one accepts or admires or does not scold the misbehavior of the worldly part of that person. Just because you see God in that person, just because you see Swami in that person and you're trying to concentrate on that good, it doesn't mean you accept the bad in that person as being good. The bad remains bad, and that's what Swami says here. Even though one sees and loves and really pays attention to God in that person, nevertheless, that person should be scolded and his attention called to his failures and shortcomings and so on. That is not being cruel. The factor here is the intention. So very, very clearly, you know, when Swami talks, that analogy of going to buy sugar is so very powerful. See, when you go to a shop to buy sugar, you don't say anything else. Is there sugar? Is that quality of sugar, you know, worthy of consumption? That's all you see. So when you go to a devotee of Swami, when you go to somebody who says that I'm, you know, this is what is Swami's message. I mean, when I say this, I'm not talking only about mediums. I'm talking even about speakers like you and me. When we are speaking something and saying that this is what Swami said, or this is what Swami is saying, it is like me selling sugar. It doesn't matter who I am, where I came from, and all of that. It matters only to a certain extent, because reputation does have a weight of its own. But finally, you have to see, what is that you're buying? If after all that, if I'm selling you something which is not sugar, then you're not going to take it, right? So similarly, the final thing which you're receiving, it has to be in line with what Swami says. Is it Swami's word? Is it true to Swami's message? If it is not, you have to discard it. However beautiful all the other setup is. It's a beautiful shop. It's a beautiful person selling the sugar.
And but that sugar is not of quality.
Sugar is not quality. You don't buy it.
And if the sugar is of quality, irrespective of what the shop is, we buy it. I think this aspect where Swami is saying that, irrespective of what is the history of the shopkeeper or what is the shop, if the sugar is of good quality, we buy it. I think that is the inspiration or motivation behind, I think, when we were doing the satsang on Jainism, we saw how they have got 24 or 32 teachers. A spider is a teacher, a wolf is a teacher.
I think Dattatreya speaks of 24 gurus.
Correct. Right? 24 gurus in Dattatreya. I think in Jainism,
there is
a concept of learning from so many other things in nature.
Right.
It is about being able to see the good. It is in line with how Swami would say, when Jesus is walking with his disciples and they see a carcass of a dog, when everybody is moving away because of the stench, Jesus smiles and says, what lovely teeth it has. So this is the ability to focus only on the sugar and good. And even if we take this message, you know, we say that, you know, irrespective of what the person is, I don't care, then let me just focus on that one aspect. You know, but it is not, that doesn't happen. When usually it so happens that, like I said, in case of celebrities, it is that sugar, that it is that one aspect that impresses us, but because of that, our love and devotion, and you know, we go and start falling at everybody's feet. We feel like, you know, you look at somebody else, you walk on the road, Prem, there'll be people who'll come and hug you and say, you're awesome. It's because of the message of Swami that you're giving. That is the sugar. But that sugar has ensured that, you know, you become sweet in every sense for everybody else. So that is what has to be avoided. As you rightly said, it is not just about the mediums, though mediums are the extreme case which needs immediate surgical operations, but it also applies to you, me, everybody else, that we need to, our focus need to be only on Swami and Swami alone. Swami continues by saying, when there is an avatar, there must always be bad. Rama's foster mother was his enemy. Krishna's uncle was his enemy even before he was born. Shirdi Baba was much abused. Not long ago, there was a man who challenged Swami to some tests. Stories appeared over a broad area, even in other countries. This man had some foreign people in his camp. Some of Swami's devotees urged Swami to reply. But to reply would have been shameful. This yogi was eating nails and glass and so on. He created a special tank for a test of water walking. Why a special tank? Something crooked. He sold tickets to spectators for up to 100 rupees and more per ticket. On the appointed day, he stepped on the water and sank in the water. The police had to put him in a cell to protect him from abuse, and all the money was refunded. Now people said what a fool he had been to challenge Swami. His disaster was a result of the foolish challenge. Later, the man wrote to Swami disclaiming any serious intent to challenge and confessed that he had used Swami's name just to increase ticket sales. The man is gone and now nothing is heard about him. In fact, Prem, when Swami said nothing is heard about him, it triggered in me the urge to actually search intensely on the internet and actually found out about this person whose name happens to be, Lakshmana Sandra Shrikanta Rao, and he used to be called Yogi Rao. Mm-hmm. So basically he had this ability, because Swami himself is saying, right, that, it comes later on. Swami himself says that he had a little power, but the moment the ego and this came, it all went away. So he gained fame for himself in India by eating nails, walking on hot fire coals, eating fire, you know, all this, eating glass pieces. There would be shows and it became quite popular in India. And once when he happened to be in US, one of the, I forget the names, but there was a media guy, you know, who took and presented him in US media, and he became an instant hit there. You know, I'm talking of the 1950s. In 1950s, media was not so great in India. Media, I think, grew and it was most powerful in US, okay, as always. Mm-hmm. So that is what led to the fame of this so-called Yogi Rao. And his fame shot to limelight when a certain Doris Duke, who was the daughter of James Buchanan Duke, who was, you know, a tobacco tycoon. She was at that point in time considered as possibly among the top three richest women in the world.
Okay.
So she became a disciple, and that is how this person's fame spread. And not only did she become a disciple, she began to contribute heavily to him. So in a span of 10 months, he became so ultra rich, this Yogi Rao. And after that, she also introduced him to a friend of hers who was at that point in time, I think, the second richest woman in the world. So with such rich financial backing, he became very popular and all that. But then he came and, as he himself confesses to an Indian writer who was a dear friend of his, he says that he felt jealous of Swami. He said that I can drink nitric acid and eat glass. This person can't do that. And how come more people are gathering to him than to me? In fact, you know, he talks to the Indian writer A.R. Kanangi, and he says, see, it is very easy to become a guru. First, you have to create an image. You can't be a sadhu if you wear trousers and jacket. And then you must spread the word that you went to Himalayas and kept your head at the feet of a guru. Nobody will check, of course, if you have actually been there. The Himalayan tag is very, very important. And then armed with powers extraordinary, you descend to the plains and begin performing miracles. I can do better than Satya Sai Baba. I can drink nitric acid, drink water and bring it out of my nose and walk on burning embers. Okay, I don't know why he's getting. So he was publicly proclaiming it. And his writer friend actually questioned him. Mm-hmm. He asked him, don't you think this is cheating? There are one or two siddhis that you can perform, of course. Using that as a way to, you know, glorify yourself as a divine phenomenon, is that not cheating? And his reply was, it is not cheating. People want this. They want to believe in miracles. They are confused and afraid. They all want a crutch for support. I'm only providing that. I thought of bringing this in our afternoon satsang, because I think there is a very important point that is being made there, that our vulnerability comes because of our interest and keenness to find an external support. Like he says here, people need a crutch, I'm just providing them the crutch. That is why we become vulnerable, that is why we become, you know, fooled, we become susceptible to all this, because of this constant search for an external crutch. Contrast that with Swami, you know, when you see, Swami from day one said, you are considering me divine, but so are you. Look for God within you. I mean, that is most destructive if you are wanting to build a divine empire in a worldly sense. but that is the truth. And Swami never, you know, kept away from saying the truth, even when it meant his head getting tonsured and getting, you know, we saw that torture that was inflicted on him at Kadri. Even if it meant that, he kept stating the truth. And it is so, so significant. And that was, and as Swami says, later on the same person writes an apologetic letter to Swami saying that, no, my intention was not this. My intention was only to increase ticket sales. And in fact, it is documented. It happened in 1964 when he tried this. A special tank was built and he stepped into the tank and he sank. And people started throwing stones because what Swami is selling, 100 rupees, that was the huge, cheapest ticket.
Right.
500 rupees also was charged.
100 for 66 was huge.
And 100 was the cheapest ticket. There have been people ranging between 100 to 500 rupees. And they all attacked him. He was taken to police custody for his own protection. And few years later, he tried to, you know, come back saying that, you know, I will now walk on water, but nobody took him seriously. And that is when, you know, he, I think, underwent a transformation and change. That part is not documented. But as Swami says, he wrote to Swami saying that my intention was not to challenge you. It was a foolish challenge. He confessed that he just wanted more popularity. Finally, it turns out that, you know, as Swami said, he had a few powers, but those powers distracted him, led him on an ego trip, a trip to vanity, which resulted in him losing those powers as well.
You know, there are a lot of very important things that comes out of this. Going to the last statement that Swami makes, you are reading out from his own words where he says that people want this and people are craving for this kind of a support. If you look at it from his point of view, somebody might look at him and say, after all, he's doing good work. He's giving solace to people. So it's that both ways how that, you know, that mistake happens, where one hand, this person is actually, you know, being a parasite on other people's problems and other people's emotional needs. And for people who are watching it, it might say, like, what's your problem? You know, after all, good work is being done and people are benefiting out of it. And that's why Swami says the intention is very, very important. And also, you know, when you're talking about the influence of the place itself or an institution itself, what has it been built on? What are the values it has been built on? What are the intentions with which anything has been made? All of that comes into relevance. And you know, when you talk of a person like this, when you talk about siddhis, I think it's not uncommon, at least in India, where you know a lot of yogis who go and acquire you know, siddhis like this. Swami would make it very, very clear. You know, there are many, many ways by which you can encash your good karma. One of the ways is by becoming a supernatural person, having supernatural abilities. To be born in a very, very rich family is actually encashing your good karma. You know, good karmas of your past is encashed in that manner. Or being born as a beautiful person, being born as a physically strong person, being born with, you know, there are some people who just have it easy in their lives. They start a business, it clicks. They start a, you know, learn something, the talent seems to be coming so easily. All of these are blessings. Always the question is, how are you going to use the blessings after it has come to you, right? And like every fortune which comes, you know, where you don't know the source, just like how, you know, a lottery comes to you, most of these good karma is also like a lottery. You don't know the source. You don't know in which birth what you have done. But when it comes to you, how do you put that to use is the challenge of character, right? It could be a yogi with the yogic powers, or it could be simply a person who is very intelligent, who is a very good speaker, who is a very good singer. All of these are talents which is left to that person, how that person uses it. And that's the most important thing. And if you look at it from that way, the way you will look at these people also will be like, yeah, he's another person who's misused a blessing which was given. Right? We get so put off when we see a spiritual person doing like this, or, you know, some Swami's devotee who has been for so many years doing like this. Finally, if you look at it, all of these comes down to the same basic human flaws, you know, greed, jealousy, and desires. So Swami started off we started this episode with that. It all finally comes down to the same problems which you and I face. It manifests in different forms. I think that is something which is very important to keep in mind.
You know, actually, when I read the next part, I just felt that finally the whole world ridiculed him, you know, mocked him and threw him out. But actually it was only Swami who actually gave him some respect and love, you know. Because here Hislop says, but Swami, why would the man be so foolish as to try to walk on water without practicing beforehand? And Swami says, the man was walking on water. Now Swami is acknowledging that he can walk on, he walks on water. But ego and greed arose and that finished it. Thought, word and deed must be the same. You know, you may be doing miraculous things, you may be speaking amazing things, but at your thought level, if you are at a very low level, if you are at the level of kama, krodha, lobha, moha, mada, matsarya, it is not going to work. And finally, I was just thinking, all said and done, you know, it is his blessing, his good fortune that Swami is acknowledging. Swami is acknowledging that he is having prowess. Swami is acknowledging that he is having the ability, because the way those articles concluded were about how heartbroken he was, and he desperately tried for 5 years to get another opportunity where he can show that he can walk on water, but nobody was ready to believe. So here was a person who could actually walk on water, but was very disappointed because nobody around him were believing. I mean, I don't know whether he realized his good fortune or whether he came to know of this conversation that has happened between Hislop and Swami. Because indeed blessed that Swami himself acknowledged, Swami says here that he is walking on water, but ego and greed brought him down. So many important points for us to keep in mind, especially now when Swami is not there in the physical and we look towards other representations of Swami in the physical.
Right, and there was one person whom I met, I think his father was working in the army and he was posted in Kashmir. He was saying that, you know, almost on a daily basis, they would have some of these yogis and sadhus coming up to their house who could do miracles like this. Mm-hmm. They would wave their hand, materialize something, and they would, you know, blow, and there would be a statue in their hand, all of this. It's typically like, you know, just like how you lose your way when you are pursuing a talent or when you're pursuing something important in life. When you get something in between, you see a lot of young, talented singers and talented actors who probably lose their way like this. Sportsmen especially. You know, when you get enormous success at a young age, you get carried away by that. You don't take your, you know, career to that completion which it possibly can. Mm. That, you know, that's why not everybody becomes a legend. You know, somewhere you have a lot of talent and then you dissipate it in this kind of mindless usage of the popularity that you've got. These are people just like that. They've definitely acquired a certain power, but they would rather encash it through, you know, these kind of means than taking it forward and, you know, reach the ultimate as Swami would want other spiritual aspirants to.
On that note, dear listeners, I think we will close this discussion, because in a sense, that theme has reached conclusion. Because after this, Hislop is asking a question which is again different from this theme so far. We hope that you have enjoyed this. We hope that we have all learnt so many things from this. We are grateful to Swami for this opportunity as always. So we offer this once again back at his lotus feet. We will end with a song, on the other side of which you'll be greeted by Brother Chandu in his segment, Love to Love.
Krishna, Krishna, nani nagenu beduvadilla, Krishna.
Krishna.